Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Well, hello. I'm glad to see all of you tonight. Technically, we are starting in Exodus 17 this evening. And if not technically, then generally, we're also starting in Exodus 17. I had an interesting experience today. I've been getting a lot of email lately from folk who are just discovering us because of all of the YouTube video and stuff that's been put out there from Reformed Voices. And so we've been getting the big push out there on the internet lately, which is great, and I'm very thankful for it. I had somebody write to me today and say they brought up something from the eschatology series, which we taught, you know, several years ago. And they said, you know, when you were doing this and that on amillennialism, you said this, and he quoted one thing. Now, there's 500 hours, for you folks out there on the internet, there's 500 hours, more than that, of MP3 teaching of me talking on our website at this moment. So if you just send a sentence and say, you said this, what did you mean, or don't you think, or you got to give me more than that. Tell me which message it was, how many minutes in it was, so that I have an opportunity to go hear what I said. Because I'm not storing all of that in my cranium, waiting for somebody to ask a specific question. So this guy asked today, and I knew there were only like two potential messages it could be in. So while I was working around the house today, I was listening to myself talk from a few years ago. And that can be a treacherous undertaking. But I was really reassured that after listening to a couple of my amillennial eschatological teaching messages, after hearing a couple hours of me, I got done and said, well, I agree with that guy.
Good. That,
we are in complete agreement. This guy's good. See, I have tapes that no one will ever hear, tucked away in my closet from when I was up in Dover, where I spent a year as the interim pastor learning how to preach and learning how to stand up in front of people with a Bible open. And that's why nobody will ever hear those tapes. Oh, you're disappointed? Don't be. It's not good. Because I go back and pull some of those tapes out once in a while and start to listen, and I just wince because it's not good.
So you're saying you're really good now, right? I did.
Just saying, God in his grace over time has done a work on this old man where at least now when I listen to myself, it's not so frightening. And thank you, Charlie. Charlie just mouthed, you're not that old. So thank you, Charlie, for lying to me.
No, she's right. You're not that old.
How old are you?
50's the new 30? Who made up that rule?
You got a t-shirt that says it, so it must be true.
My whole life, people kept telling me, life begins at 40. Life begins at 40. And then I hit 40, and I made it to 50, and I can tell all you youngsters now, life began at 21. And I was just way too busy to notice. Yeah.
I agree with you.
Trust me on this one. Exodus 17, verse 8. The Israelites, as a group, following Moses, following God, were brought to Rephidim. When they got there, there was no water. And we identified that area, Rephidim, last week, as being the same area of the wilderness where Moses went when he spent his 40 years in exile out in the wilderness, having run out of Egypt. He was in this same territory. The reason that that's important is that by the time we get to chapter 18 tonight, his father-in-law is going to show up, which is natural. He's back in the area where he first met Jethro, his father-in-law, and met Zipporah, who he eventually married. So what you need to know is this is all taking place in a territory that Moses is familiar with. He spent 40 years in this area. And in fact, he goes to Horeb, Mount Horeb, which is going to be the same place eventually where he's going to get the law. But it is the place where he saw the burning bush. And so this is a very familiar territory for Moses. And while he's there, starting in verse 8, Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. Now, you can just read right by that and read Amalek and go, okay, who's that? Amalek, somebody, the descendants of a guy named Amalek, family of Amalek, tribe of Amalek, came and fought with Israel. Why? They're in the wilderness. They're in a place where there's no water. Why would these people, whoever they consist of, named Amalek, why would the Amalekites be particularly interested in fighting Israel? Well, the only way to answer that question is God's sovereignty. And now I'm going to tell you why that answers the question. Amalek is a grandson of Esau. Interesting, huh? And let's see now. Jacob have I loved. Esau have I hated. While the two babies were still in the womb, as Paul says in Romans 9, while the two kids, having done neither any evil or any good, it was said to him, the elder will serve the younger, so that God's election by grace would stand. So here now we've got the Abrahamic covenant, and as the covenant is playing out generation to generation, the elder of the two, Esau, was supposed to get the inheritance of his father's. But his brother basically tricked him and then tricked his dad, and in so doing also fulfilled exactly what God said was going to be the case, so that the blessing ended up going to Jacob, because that's who God chose to give the blessing to. So that through Jacob's lineage, not only would all Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel, grow, Jacob had his name changed to Israel, so to this day, both the land of Israel and all the people of Israel still bear his name, but his brother Esau hated him because he lost the land inheritance, lost his father's inheritance, and so all of that took place back in Genesis. We saw all that. Now God, 400 years after sending the Israelites into the promised land, is in the process of bringing the Israelites to that promised land that is their inheritance. So who shows up to fight them? The people who lost the inheritance. The people whose inheritance it would have been, being the descendants of the elder brother. Now the Esauites are later known as the Edomites. You may know that name. And they are to this day the fiercest enemies of Israel. We know them today as the Arabs. And these are all descendants of Esau and Ishmael, the Ishmaelites, the folks who were not given by God's sovereign election, not given the land inheritance in the Middle East. And so they are adamant in their hatred against the Israelites, the chosen of God. So it is not random that Moses writes in chapter 17, verse 8, just out of nowhere, it seems like it just comes out of nowhere, when he writes, "And Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim." But they have a long, rich history of fighting the Amalekites, and that idea is going to come up a lot in the Old Testament. So let's read first the rest of chapter 17, and then we're going to read a few other references to the Amalekites, and you're going to see how prominently they play in the history of Israel once they occupy their own land. But it's certainly no mistake that the people who would come to resist the Israelites, the minute they get into the wilderness, before they even get to Sinai, before they even get the law, before they get to the land, who comes to resist them? Who comes to fight them? Of course, the descendants of Esau show up. So the answer is sovereignty. So, verse 9, Moses said to Joshua, "Choose men for us and go out and fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." Why would he take the staff of God with him? Well, this is the same staff that he's used continually when he touched the Nile River with it. Remember what happened?
Turned to blood.
When he held the staff up over the Red Sea, Red Sea parted. God told him specifically that when he struck the rock, he was supposed to use that staff. And so this is representative of God in their midst And so he says, I'm going to go up on the hill where I can oversee the war that's taking place in the valley, and I'm going to take the rod of God with me. He's hoping that he's going to be able to influence the outcome here in some positive way. And Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about that when Moses held his hand up, which means that he lifted the staff, that Israel prevailed. But when he let his hands down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy, as you might expect. Get a big walking stick, large staff, try to hold it over your head for a while. That's going to get tiresome. So they, the other two, Aaron and Hur, took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sunset. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Now, was this strictly a human endeavor? Did they win because they fought the best? No, it's clear that they won because God intervened on their behalf, and whenever Moses held up the staff, they were winning. If he dropped the staff, they were losing, and so Aaron and Hur wisely sit Moses down, lift his hands up, standing on either side of him, holding it up so that they would win, and then look at God's reaction in verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial. In other words, I'm not trusting this one to your memory. You need to write this down, and you need to tell this to future generations. Write it in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and named it, The Lord is my banner. Now, a couple things here. Did the friction between the Amalekites and the Israelites start as the result of, random land war? Why were these two at odds with each other? Sovereignty, God's sovereignty. They were at enmity with each other, at war with each other because of God's sovereignty. Then, even though it was God's sovereignty that put these two nations of people against each other through God's sovereign choice, even though that was the cause of the enmity, does God take sides? Yeah. And does God say, these people, I'm going to take to the promised land, and I'm going to preserve. And to this day, all over the world, pretty much every country in the world, you can find descendants, Israelites, Jews, you can find them all over the world. Anybody met an Amalekite lately?
No.
No, the Amalekites were systematically wiped out. Those are descendants of Esau. Now, this is one tribe of Esau's descendants. This is one of his grandchildren through one of his children. So this is a tribe of Arabs. But the Esauites, who are known as Edomites, became the Arab tribes. You probably don't remember, but when God cast off Sarah's bondwoman, Hagar, and her son, he also said that he was going to be a great king, and he was going to be a king over 12 tribes, and so he was going to be a king over nations. So this is just one of those tribes. Okay? So my point is that even though God quite sovereignly put the enmity between these two groups, he also took sides between the two groups. He chose sovereignly that he was going to love Jacob and that he was going to reject Esau. And Paul is so clear in Romans 9 to say, and the babies hadn't done a thing. They're still in the womb. Hadn't done anything good, hadn't done anything evil. That the reason it worked out that way was so that God's sovereignty in election by grace was going to stand. And even though God formed the enmity between these two groups, he still took sides for Israel and said, I'm going to wipe out the Amalekites for the way they attacked Israel while they were in the wilderness. Now that concept that the Amalekites attacked Israel in the wilderness, that concept is brought up several more times in the Old Testament. This moment becomes a moment that is written down in a book and then recited exactly as God says it should be. And he said, this is Moses speaking, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. So the Lord is going to fight against Amalek from generation to generation. It's written down in a book, and it's recorded because Amalek attacked Israel in the wilderness. So turn real quickly over to the book of Numbers. Mark Exodus 17, and we'll get back there in a minute. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, bless you. Numbers 24. You probably all know the story of Balaam and Balaam's donkey. Well, Balaam had been brought in by enemy kings to curse Israel. And every time that Balaam asked God about it, God ended up blessing Israel. And so Balaam is really at odds with the kings who were trying to get Balaam to curse Israel. And in the midst of it, let's start at verse 17. Well, I can't start there. Okay, he took up this discourse and said, verse 15. This is the oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down yet having his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob, and a scepter shall rise from Israel, and he shall crush through the forehead of Moab, and bear down all the sons of Sheth, and Edom shall be a possession, Seir its enemies also shall be a possession, while Israel performs valiantly. And one from Jacob shall have dominion and shall destroy the remnant from the city. And he looked at Amalek, and he took up his discourse and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall be destruction. And what's he talking about there? God has said, write it down. Remember it through all your generations. God is going to fight against Amalek. And so in the midst of all this messianic language, one of the things that he brings up is that Israel is going to possess all these lands that even to this day are currently possessed by all of their ancient enemies, the Edomites. And from Jacob, there's going to be dominion, though. And then he's going to destroy the remnant from the city. And on Amalek, who was the first of the nations. In what way can Amalek be said to be the first of the nations? He was the firstborn. He's the descendant of the firstborn. He's the one that's supposed to have the land inheritance. And yet, despite the fact that he was the first, his end will be destruction. Now, when you read stuff like that, if you're anything like me, and I hope you're not, you pause for a moment and say, why? Okay, Balaam has just thrown out this prophecy. Even though Amalek was the head of the nations, his end is going to be destruction. Why? Is it because he attacked Israel in the wilderness? Or is it because God sovereignly, way back when, said the elder is going to serve the younger, and it's been that way ever since? Turn to the book of Deuteronomy. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Turn to Deuteronomy 25. In the midst of the law, this is God laying out the Deuteronomical law. Moses keeping track of it. Let's start at like verse 14. This will give you some idea of how varied the laws are. Verse 13, you shall not have in your bag different weights, a large and a small, so that all your weights are even. You shall not have in your house different measures, a large and a small. And you shall have a full and a just weight, and you shall have a full and a just measure, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. For everyone who does these things, everyone who acts unjustly, is an abomination to the Lord your God. Remember what Amalek did. What? Where does that come from? Well, he's talking about justice and being fair and being just. And he suddenly says, and remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out from Egypt. How he met you along the way and attacked among you all of the stragglers at the rear when you were faint and weary and he did not fear God. Therefore, it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, that you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget. So he even put it in the law now. First, he told Moses, write it down. Now it's part of the law. Remember what Amalek did. And when you get to your land, blot them out. One of the more famous Amalekites in the history of Israel, one of the major kings of Amalek, was a guy named Agag, which may have been a title name or may have been the name of the king, and then it became a title, kind of like Caesar. In the book of Esther, there's a guy named Haman. Anybody remember Haman? How many of you know the book of Esther? Remember the story of the book of Esther? Esther was a Jewish princess, and she has an uncle named Mordecai. And this is where this wonderful phrase, who knows but that you've come to the kingdom for such an hour as this, that's the context of that great quote, that she was taken in front of the Persian king, Artaxerxes, as one of the many hundreds of women that were paraded in front of him because he was looking for a new wife. And wow, what a surprise. He decided Esther was the one. But he didn't know she was Jewish. And so he takes her in, and then there's this guy named Haman, who is right up there, right-hand man with the king, who hates the Jews, who is determined to wipe out and kill all the Jews, and through lying and chicanery has gotten the king to sign an edict to kill all the Jews. And then she goes and talks to her uncle about it, and that's when her uncle says, you got to go in and talk to the king. She says, but if I go in and he doesn't raise the scepter, I'm dead. And he says, well, who knows but that you've come into the kingdom for such an hour as this. Maybe this is God's big divine plan. Maybe that's why you're here. She goes in and talks to the king, and I won't tell you the whole rest of the story outside of saying she ends up saving Israel, all the Jews that are in the area there. Well, in the midst of all that, there's this guy Haman, who is the enemy of all the Jews, and he is described as an Agagite. He's a leader of the Amalekites. And to this day, every year when the book of Esther is read in the temple, in Jewish synagogues, whenever the word Haman is said, they will yell and jeer and make noise. They even bring noisemakers sometimes so that they don't have to hear his name, because the name of the Amalekites is to be blotted out from under heaven. And they take that so seriously that they don't even want to hear the name of Haman because he's an Agagite, an Amalekite. Turn to 1 Samuel 15 for a moment.
I've got a question before we leave that part.
Yeah.
There might be a subtlety there that's going completely over top of my head, but it says to blot out the memory of Amalek, and then it says don't forget. It looks like a clash.
The don't forget is when you come into your land, don't forget to wipe them out.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, that's what we're about to see now. That's why we're going to 1 Samuel, is we're going to see the attempt to wipe them out. So go over to 1 Samuel. If you're in Deuteronomy, then you're going to go through Joshua, Judges, Ruth, then 1 and 2 Samuel. So 1 Samuel, let's start in chapter 15. And we'll start right at the top of this. Well, we shouldn't. We should. Well, in chapter 14, this is very difficult. Saul is now king of Israel. Saul was the king that the Israelites wanted because he was a head taller than everybody else. And they wanted a king like all the surrounding nations had a king. And God intended to be their king. They were to be a theocracy, but no, they wanted an earthly king. So God even says, well, I'm going to give you a king, but if I do, he's going to tax you like crazy, and he's going to take all the best tradespeople to work for him, and he's going to take the best of the women, and he's going to really rout you to make himself wonderful. And they said, okay, good enough. And they ended up with Saul, who did exactly all of that. Well, he's been told by Samuel the prophet that he's to go into war, and in this war that he is to wipe out, take care of, get rid of the Amalekites. And instead, in the midst of the warfare, let's start at chapter 14, verse 47, so you only have to go back a little bit. Now, when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, He fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, and the kings of Zobah and the Philistines. And wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. And he acted valiantly, and he defeated the Amalekites, as he was expected to do, based on what God had told them, when you go into the land to fight the Amalekites. And he delivered the Israelites from the hand of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishvi and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Meriband, and the name of the second was Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of, Ahimaaz? Your guess is as good as mine. The daughter of Dave. And the name... I'm going to go with that. That would be the English cognate of Ahimaaz. And the name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, who was Saul's uncle. And Kish was the father of Saul. And Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. Then Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put him to death, both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." Now what did the camels do? Yeah, they just happened to be part of the Amalek tribe, and God wanted him wiped out completely. And why? Remember what he did. Remember how he came out and attacked you. Remember when you were coming out of Egypt. Remember, God has a very long memory here. And it is wise to do what God says. But look what Saul did. So then Saul summoned the people and numbered them. And there were 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to the city of Amalek, this is verse 5, and set an ambush in the valley. And Saul said to the Kenites, "Go depart, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt." So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur and to the east of Egypt. And he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the best of the oxen and the fatlings and the lambs and everything that was good. And he was not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything that was despised and worthless, that he utterly destroyed. Uh-oh is right. Did he do what God said to do?
No, he didn't.
God was very clear about what to do with the Amalekites. Wipe them out completely. Men, women, children, animals, wipe them out. I don't want to hear about them anymore. And so Saul decided for himself that he was going to keep the good stuff. It's a sheep. It's a camel. What can it do wrong? They're good. They're healthy animals. I'll keep them. They're good for milk. They're good for food. God won't mind. Despite the fact that God said, here's how to do it, he decided to do it his own way.
Are these also the animals that he decided to make a sacrifice?
Mm-hmm. That's coming up. Okay. Yep. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, "I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me, and he has not carried out my commands." And Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night. And Samuel rose up early in the morning to go meet Saul. And it was told Samuel, saying, "Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself, and then turned and proceeded on down to Gilgal. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, 'Blessed are you of the Lord, I've carried out the command of the Lord.'" Is that true?
Yeah.
lying through his kingly teeth. So he's busy saying, "Blessed are you of the Lord. I've carried out the command of the Lord." But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears? And what is the sound of the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" And Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen." And then look how he justifies it. "To sacrifice to the Lord your God. But the rest we have utterly destroyed." So not only did I not do it God's way, I improved on God's plan. And even though I didn't do it God's way, it was to glorify God. It was to offer to God. Is God pleased when you do things your way instead of his?
No.
Even if you try to justify it as, "Well, this brings more glory to God, according to me." Well, here's what happens. Samuel said to Saul, "Wait, and let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he said to him, "Speak." And Samuel said, "Is it not true, though you were little in your own eyes and were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated?' Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord?" What did he do that was so evil? Yeah, he disobeyed. Now, the action itself was, "Well, these are good animals. Why just kill them? These animals can be used. I could feed my army with these. We can get milk. We can get clothing. We can get these are good animals. We'll keep these animals. They're just animals. They're not sinful. And then the good sheep that we kept, we'll sacrifice to God. That'll be great. It's perfect. The sin in all of it is God said, 'Don't do that. Wipe out the Amalekites, wipe out their animals, don't want to hear about them anymore.' As a consequence, God says that it is sin and evil in the sight of the Lord." And then Saul said to Samuel in verse 20, "I did obey the voice of the Lord, and I went on the mission on which the Lord sent me, and I have brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites." What was he told to do to Agag, the king of the Amalekites?
Kill him.
Not bring him back alive, not spare him. Why do you think Saul decided to keep him alive?
Trophy for himself.
Show off. Here's the king. I defeated the king. Very typical of kings in wars. Here's my defeated enemy. But, verse 21, "But the people," notice again, "I brought back Agag the king. But the people took some of the spoil, the sheep and the oxen, the choicest of the things that were devoted to destruction, and they took them to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal." And Samuel said, "Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as he does in obeying the voice of the Lord?" It's an important question. Because over the course of your life, you're going to have opportunities, moments in your life, where you're going to have to make tough choices. And you're going to say, "Okay, now I know what the right thing is to do here. And I know what the biblical thing is, but I'm betting I could justify my other choice. I'm betting if I don't do it the biblical way, that I could spin it in such a way that I could justify it to myself. In fact, I could probably even justify it to other people. I could even get other people to agree with me that my alternate choice was a good choice because some other good came from it. We're going to sacrifice to God. We're going to be able to eat these animals. It's helping the people to not go hungry. All that justify. But the simple reality is the God who doesn't change isn't as interested here in burnt sacrifice, which was the highest form of worship to God that men could do at this point. You would go and sacrifice good things to God, burn them utterly, destroy them for God's pleasure, sending that sweet savor into his nostrils. This was one of the highest forms of worship there was. And he said, God isn't as interested in your burnt sacrifice as he is in you doing what he said to do, instead of deciding for yourself what you'll do, even if you can put a good justification on it. "Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. Did you get that? To obey is better than sacrifice. And to heed God is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft or divination. For you to decide for yourself what you're going to do, no matter how well you justify it, he says that's as evil as the sin of witchcraft, which people would say, no, witchcraft in Israel is no witchcraft. Oh, can't. No, we would never do that. And here Samuel says to him, you're just as guilty as anybody who's practicing witchcraft because you haven't obeyed God. You're sinning against God. Insubordination is as iniquitous as idolatry because you have rejected the word of the Lord. And he has also then rejected you from being king. So then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed the command of the Lord, and I have transgressed your words because I feared the people and I listened to their voice. Boy, that's a very common problem, isn't it? Is it worth making the application? Sure it is. We're here. Is it worth making the application that in most churches, at least in America right now, the trend is toward listen to the people rather than listen to God? Whatever the people want, whatever the people want to hear, whatever entertainment the people want, whatever it takes to make the people happy, whatever it takes to get them to come back, whatever it takes to get money out of their wallet while they're there, then whatever it is they want, if the people say, we want puppets, you know, well, here's, we want a show, okay, we'll do a show, you know, we want drama, we'll give you that. We don't want long sermons, you know, okay, well, we'll cut it down to 10 minutes max. We want more music, okay, we'll give you more, we want rock bands, well, you can have that. All the way back here, you've got the first king of Israel being rejected because he listened to the voice of the people instead of listening to the voice of God. Listen to the voice of God is the only appropriate response. Well, I think we could make the point over and over and over again here that God, who doesn't change, expects you to listen, respond, and be obedient. And no matter how you spin it or how many sacrifices you bring, if you're not doing it his way and listening to what he has plainly said, then you're in rebellion, which he says is like idolatry and witchcraft, even though you think it's just your free will or your decision-making or your choice. Got all that? Okay, one more quick passage here. Turn to 1 Samuel 28, a couple chapters forward.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, of course.
When, you know, it says, now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, you know, and he gave him these instructions. Was that in a dream or what? I mean, how was that given to him? Because, you know,
in Samuel's case, I believe it was an audible voice because his prophetic ministry began with him being given to Eli because his mother had been barren and had gone in and prayed, and then she was given a child, so she gave him to the work of the Lord. And then in the night, he heard a voice say, Samuel, and it woke him up. And he went into Eli. It was such a, to him, it was so audible that he went to Eli and said, what? And Eli said, I didn't call you. Go to bed. And so he goes back to bed, and he hears it again, Samuel. And he goes into Eli and says, here I am. What? I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. Eli perceives it is the Lord. And he says, next time you hear the voice, say, speak, Lord. You know? So that's what he does. And that's the beginning of his prophetic life. So I would say that it is an audible voice that he's able to hear. But I don't see that as being that different from Peter being on the Mount of Transfiguration and hearing a voice from heaven that says, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Or John the Baptist hearing that when the Holy Spirit as a dove lands on Jesus, that's my beloved Son. Or Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? So Old or New Testament, we have God direct communicating with particular people. And even though I'm suspicious when people say that God speaks to them these days, I certainly have plenty of evidence that he can and does, but you can determine the validity of their speech based on what they say God said. It's either going to match this or it's not. Where are we? We're in chapter 28. Now, Saul His kingship is in disarray by this point. And because of what he's heard, he has outlawed all the witches, all the necromancers, anybody who can talk to the dead. He sent them all off. But now he really needs to talk to Samuel, and Samuel's dead. And so he goes to Endor and finds a witch. And the witch claims to pull up the spirit of Samuel, and it reads as if the spirit of Samuel actually rises and speaks. And it's very interesting that at this critical juncture, at this specific moment, what comes up again? Well, let's look at verse 16, see if we can start there. No, let's go back a little bit. Because I like this story, and when are we ever going to be here again?
When we get there again.
Yeah, it's going to be a long time. Chapter 28, verse 1. It came about in those days that the Philistines gathered their armed camps for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, "Know assuredly that you will go out with me in the camp, you and your men." And David said to Achish, "Very well, you shall know what your servant can do." So Achish said to David, "Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life." Now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, his own city. And Saul had removed from the land those who were mediums and spiritists. So the Philistines gathered together and came and camped in Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they camped at Gilboa. And Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, and he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by the Urim or by the prophets. And of course, his prophet was always Samuel. It was always Samuel who told him what God was thinking. And he needs to know, the Philistines are encamping. Am I going to get beat? Am I going to lose my kingdom? I need to talk to Samuel. Then Saul said to his servant, "Seek for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go into her and inquire of her." And the servant said to him, "Behold, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor." And Saul disguised himself by putting on other clothes, and he went, and he and the other two men came with him, and they came to the woman by night, and he said, "Conjure up for me, please, and bring up for me whom I shall name to you." But the woman said to him, "Behold, you know what Saul, the king, has done, how he has cut off those who are mediums and spiritists from the land. Why are you then laying a snare for my life, to bring about my death?" And Saul vowed to her by the Lord, saying, "As the Lord lives, there shall be no punishment come upon you for this thing." And the woman said, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" And he said, "Bring up Samuel for me." And the woman saw Samuel, and she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman spoke to Saul, saying, "Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul." By the way, there's a wonderful commentary. I'm trying to remember who wrote it a few years ago about this passage. And he said the fact that the woman screamed out and shouted with a loud voice implies that she was a little surprised too, that Samuel actually showed up. Because very often the spiritists and mediums were pretty much like you see today. Lots of fakes, lots of showmanship, and that when she called up Samuel from the dead and he showed up, it says that she screamed, which had to have been kind of a surprise. And then when she saw that Samuel, the prophet, showed up, that's when she realized, oh my gosh, you are Saul, you are the king. So she's in fear for her life. So the woman, verse 12, saw Samuel and cried out with a loud voice. And the woman spoke to Saul, saying, "Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul." And the king said to her, "Do not be afraid. For what do you see?" And the woman said to Saul, "I see a divine being coming up out of the earth." And he said to her, "What is his form?" And she said, "An old man is coming up, and he's wrapped in a robe." And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground, and he did homage. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" And Saul answered, "I am greatly distressed, for the Philistines are waging war against me, and God has departed from me and answers me no more, either through prophets or by dreams. Therefore I have called you, that you may make known to me what I should do." And Samuel said, "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary? And the Lord has done according as he spoke through me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor, to David. And as you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his fierce wrath on Amalek, so the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also give over Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. In other words, you'll all be dead. Indeed, the Lord will give over the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines. And Saul immediately fell full length upon the ground and was very afraid because of the words of Samuel. So what does Samuel bring up in the midst of all this? You're going to lose the kingdom. Why? He didn't wipe out the Amalekites. That's the point of all this. It's all we've been talking about tonight, is that God said, wipe out the Amalekites. Well, as we progress, then you see the succession of kings. It's eventually going to be a king named Hezekiah who's going to be the one to find the last remnants of the Amalekites. He's going to be the one to wipe out the remnant of the Amalekites. So Israel has this long history of dealing with the Amalekites, who God sovereignly put at enmity with them, and then God held them accountable for the fact that they attacked Israel. And then through the history of Israel, God purposefully kept fighting with them till he wiped them out completely. That's the kind of God you're dealing with. Yes?
So there still were Amalekites at this time, Hezekiah's after?
Yeah. There were a few that had fled. Naturally, like in any war.
There's only the one guy.
Right. There's just the king that he brought back with him. But like as in any war, there are always those who run for cover and hide. Okay. And so there was still this little remnant. And it's Hezekiah that roots them out and finally is done with them.
King?
With Agag?
Did they kill him?
Yes. So you're getting a feel for the whole Amalekite thing? The point of the whole Amalekite story, you can read right past it in Exodus 17:8, and you can just read that the Amalekites attacked Israel. And you would go, okay, but I like doing the detective work. I want to know why the Amalekites, why not anybody else? And then you go back and you find out that they are the descendants of Esau. And Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated. Now you go, ah, this is that enmity that's between them anyway. And here God is taking them back to the promised land that they're fighting about anyway. So they fight with them over the promised land. Then God holds them responsible for the fact that they have enmity against the Israelites, which enmity God created in the first place. God holds them responsible for that. And then once he raises up their first king, gives King Saul the command to wipe out the Amalekites. And then, of course, Saul loses the kingdom for not wiping out the Amalekites. That's how important this is, because it all began with God saying, write it down in a book and tell Aaron, when you get into your land, get rid of the Amalekites. They're going to be a problem. And the reason that God said to wipe them out was that he held them accountable for attacking Israel on their way out of Egypt, on their way to the promised land. But even that enmity goes all the way back to two twins in a womb. You got all that? Yeah. So now, I've said many, many times, you cannot understand history, and you can't understand world geopolitical structures and grids if you don't understand your Bible. It's always interesting to listen to these folks in Washington talk about how they're going to solve the problem in the Middle East. And, you know, if we can just get this guy and that guy on the White House lawn and get them to shake hands and sign something, that's going to solve all our problems in the Middle East. But the hatred that is going on between the Israelites and the Edomite, Esauite, Ishmaelite descendants, the Arabs, that's not going to be solved just because a couple guys shook hands. It goes way back. It goes back to two twins in a womb. It goes back to cast off the bondwoman and her child. And that's not going to be solved through political maneuvering. It's going to be solved when the Prince of Peace comes back. And he rules with that iron rod and goes around busting up nations like he's busting up pottery. And he's going to set up his kingdom that is going to destroy all the other kingdoms of the earth. And for the first time, there will be peace on the planet. And until then, there's going to be this inexplicable tension going on between the descendants of those two twins. And God has always been on the side of the Israelites, which is why there are still Israelites. And along the way, he's taken whole people groups and just wiped them off the planet. There just aren't any more Amalekites. Now, does that mean that God favors one group of people over another?
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly what it means. That's precisely what it means. It means that God picks and chooses, that God takes sides, and that God has preferences. And despite the fact that modern concepts of God aren't comfortable with that idea, you can't read your Bible and come to any other conclusion. Right? It's only like 8:05, and I'm done. See? I get extra credit tonight. Yeah, I know. I didn't hold you here all night. I get extra credit.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.